Welcome back to another episode of the Tourism Geographies podcast, brought to you by the journal Tourism Geographies. We hope that you've been keeping well since the last episode and looking forward to learning more about the cutting-edge research in tourism and geographies published in the journal Tourism Geographies. Now, let's get into this week's episode. And so far, we're into season two, and we've had over 50 episodes. And I'm sure for those of you listening, you've listened to most of those other episodes before. So the episodes and the nature of them needs no introduction to you. Today, I'm coming to you from Sydney in Australia, as is my guest, Felicity Picken. Dr. Felicity Picken is from Western Sydney University. She's a senior lecturer in tourism, and her recent paper in tourism geographies was titled Tourism and the Blue Economy. This paper is available open access. So after this podcast, if you're interested in knowing more about the paper, please feel free to go to the journal website where you will find the article. With those introductions out of the way, let me say hello and introduce Felicity. Felicity, are you there?
I am. Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you for joining us, Felicity. We're delighted to have your paper, Tourism and the Blue Economy, published in Tourism Geographies. This was published early in December, and already it has received quite a lot of attention, and it seems to me that the discussions of the blue economy are timely. As you say in the abstract to your paper, the blue economy is formally recognized by the United Nations as a term that aims to develop a comprehensive understanding of economic activity that takes place within or through ocean and freshwater bodies of water. Without giving the game away, I will let Felicity go through all of that. But as I said, this paper is available open access on the journal's website. So Felicity, tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to being a researcher in tourism.
Thanks, Joseph. And I just want to say at the outset, thanks so much for involving me in this podcast. It's a fantastic opportunity to be here and speak to you. I guess my interest came from two loves that are not particularly unique. So one is a love of oceans, and I know I share that with a lot of other people around the world. And secondly, from a love of tourism, which I also share with a lot of other people around the world. So fairly generalized ideas and loves and passions that drew me to this space to begin with. More specifically though, I had a very fortunate, I think, childhood growing up on an island called Rottnest off the coast of Western Australia, which was purely a tourist island. So the only economy that exists there is tourism. And consequently, everyone who lives there is also part of the tourism industry. So I had this upbringing, I guess, where I was highly conscious of being a host and a member of a host community, but also as I got older, working in the same tourism industry on that island. In fact, my life was sort of arranged around the seasonal peaks and troughs of tourists, and how the environment that I lived in changed significantly throughout the year according to when the tourists were and were not there. So I felt that I had this natural connection with tourism and an understanding of it that I think might be a little bit more specific. Coupled with this, I had this traveller's curiosity about the world. I was always interested in the world around me and in being a tourist. I guess I donned the tourist gaze as often as I could, even in places that were quite close to home. So I'm just a naturally curious person that led me to a fascination with being a tourist. And then my family, who had a habit of moving to places they had visited as tourists, moved us all to Tasmania, which was another island, a much bigger one. And so I went there first as a tourist, then we moved as a resident. And I was looking for something to fulfill my future life and thought, well, tourism is clearly important to this island, and it's something that I feel I have an affinity with already. So I began studying tourism at the university there. And I absolutely loved it because I was an indecisive person, and tourism is an interdisciplinary field of study. And I took great joy in being able to study an object, if you like, or a field from various disciplinary perspectives and not having to jump onto one sort of disciplinary orthodoxy over another. As far as the ocean goes, living on Rottnest, of course, I developed a great affinity with the Indian Ocean, which I swam in regularly as a part of my life, but just a general love in seaward environments and the health-giving properties that I think they give, and the sense of well-being that they often give to people, that's well noted now. Then when I did my PhD, I was looking at particularly the new methodologies around materialism and the role that they were playing in trying to reshape our relationships with nature in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great love of nature, but also was very disturbed at the way we had formed relationships with it, and a deep feeling that the problem wasn't at the surface, but was quite deep. And so wanting to delve into those philosophical underpinnings of how we think about nature and how we relate to nature. And in trying to give nature, I guess, a different position. So to move away from what's now sort of widely noted as these human-centered ontologies where humans act upon and are in some way inseparable or separate from nature, to embedding humanity more within nature and realizing its interconnectedness with nature. As a way of hopefully dispelling this notion of a kind of powerful human, a masterful human that can impact nature. And this was pretty timely given the development of sustainability that was rising at the time and also, of course, the Anthropocene that we live in now. And it also links up very nicely, I think, with some New Age religions and some religious beliefs like Buddhism, this notion of being interconnected, but also with Indigenous ontologies and knowledges. Trying to think through different ways of relating to nature. So with that in mind, I started to think about oceans because they're very lively non-humans. Nobody could say that they don't act upon us. Mm-hmm. But also they're very, very understood. They weren't places that we had necessarily gained very much knowledge and therefore mastery over. So right. For me, oceans became these kind of fabulous laboratories where we could learn so much about how we relate to nature in a different kind of environment. We seem to have done so well, in inverted commas, mastering our relationships with land. But in oceans, we were kind of recentered. We weren't as comfortable there. Mm-hmm. And so I found on this planet Earth a fabulous place, a watery environment where humans could kind of relearn that interconnectedness. So pairing that with my interest in tourism and its very long and enduring relationship with oceanic spaces, it was a kind of a no-brainer that I would fall into to this world of blue tourism. Mm-hmm. And that's what really led me to taking notice of the blue economy and the emergence of that.
Well, fantastic. Thank you, Felicity, for that that background and overview. It now makes sense to me because as I was reading the paper, your words come across as an appeal in some ways, right? For us, as whoever's reading the paper, whether we be researchers or policymakers or practitioners, to get a full understanding of what the blue economy means to us, and in particular, what we do to it, the extent and nature of what we are doing to it. And I really I now understand where you come from. For those of you who are listening and are not familiar with Australia, where Felicity grew up on Rottnest Island is very famous for a little creature, am I right, Felicity, called the quokka?
Yes.
And like all furry, cute creatures, they become subject to humans wanting to cuddle them and embrace them and take lots of photos of them. But that's not what this podcast is about necessarily. This podcast is about the blue economy. So with your background and your perspectives and where you come from, in terms of being able to generate this paper, it's clear that in this paper, your personal and professional worlds collide. So I wanted to ask you, what do you understand the blue economy to be?
Well, I think the blue economy, for as far as I have read, is definitely something that is still under construction. And I think that there's a lot we can gain from that. I think in one sense, that can be very frustrating that it is quite imprecise. But on the other hand, depending on how you view it, that can be mean that it's open to possibility still.
Yes.
So I guess those scholars that are looking for a clear and concise definition of what the blue economy is may be frustrated when they start reading into this space. But those that are more interested in maybe taking a role in shaping what that definition might be or are happy dealing with that imprecision will be quite excited by the concept. So it is still under construction. It's new, it's emerging, and it will develop over time. It originated, I guess, for most points, at least at the United Nations 2012 Conference for Sustainable Development, mm-hmm. Much like the Brundtland Conference that developed the term sustainable development.
Yes.
So that's the kind of formal starting point. But I mean, arguably, it's been around for longer, but maybe not as formalised. And so I guess my first point would be that the blue economy is really an attempt to formalise the mm-hmm. kind of activities that take place in blue spaces. Now, that's a bit of a sort of vague term, blue spaces, but it's really the better term to use. And part of the reason for that is because it's not only referring to oceanic space, although inevitably that's where it ends up. So it's often overrun with oceanic concerns. But in its wider conception, the blue economy also refers to inland or freshwater spaces as well. So all watery bodies, if you like, on this planet, which is, of course, called the blue planet because it is largely a watery planet. So it's an attempt, I guess, to organise and manage these spaces and the kind of economic activities that take place there. And this includes a level of trying to standardize and to measure. So the minute we invoke the term sustainability, we're in the world of standardizing and measurement. So it's a very ambitious concept right at the start. Mm-hmm. And to apply to that, of course, the tenets of sustainability to both oceans and freshwater bodies of water. Mm-hmm. So it relates directly to Sustainable Development Goal 14, the sustainable use of oceans. But again, that neglects those freshwater bodies, which also need to be part of our considerations.
Yeah.
More concernedly, in some of our some of you who might move into this space will see this in some of the scholarship papers and the policy documents. The blue economy is often narrowed. Mm-hmm. So it loses that sense of sustainability and that original broader concept given to it by the UN and becomes something like encapsulated in phrases like oceans as the next great economic frontier. Mm-hmm. And that really concerns me because, you know, that's right. Dropping the sustainability. Yeah. And basically it sort of becomes this very exciting space for people who want to make a lot of money out of exploiting resources to play. Mm-hmm. So often it becomes reduced, as we see in a lot of sustainable or a lot of economic activity, wherever it takes place, to privileging economics. Right. And so for some, the blue economy simply means this wonderful wide blue space that we can now accelerate economic activity into. But its original definition, and I think the one we need to hold fast to, really does have its origins in sustainability and an attempt to understand the economic activity taking place in these spaces.
Right. And I think what the point you make is that, you know, in practice, the vastness of blue spaces, and because it's largely out of mind, out of sight, blue spaces have been used as this kind of zone for multiple things, dumping and exploitation, for example. And we see here in Pacific Islands the conversation about subseabed mining accelerating, right? And it kind of touches on what you've just said there. So with that said, Felicity, why do you think tourism is important to the blue economy?
Well, in thinking about this, I do take a sort of a blue sky approach. So thinking about the very best that tourism can be, not to ignore the exploitation that tourism is involved in and how tourism can have much less than optimal outcomes. But if we think about the positive sides of tourism when thinking about why it's important in this space, then I guess the obvious textbook answer to that is because so much tourism takes advantage of, takes place within, near or around blue spaces. So arguably, it's a big player in this field, and it also delivers some of those benefits, both economic and social benefits to communities. And small island states are a perfect example of that. In fact, they're the kind of pièce de résistance when we think about these spaces. So that's the kind of textbook answer. It's important because tourism's a big player in this space. But of course, we need to always apply that caveat that the industry can always do better in delivering the kind of benefits to more of the people who are involved. But as importantly to me, when I think about it, is tourism's really important when we think about the blue economy, because it's the one industry that puts people in place. Mm-hmm. And it puts a wider range of people in place. So for example, if we think about fishing and aquaculture, which take up a lot of thinking around the blue economy, that puts workers in those industries into these blue spaces. And they earn a living from these activities. And we can assume, without being too cynical, that they aim to optimise the returns from that living in the practices that they undertake in these spaces. And we can say the same kind of thing about mining and energy sectors. So the predominant group of people that enter into these spaces to undertake that activity are working specifically for those industries. Mm-hmm. But tourism's a little bit different. So those tourists don't necessarily, they're not earning money from being in these spaces. They're not there to necessarily gain much more than a wonderful experience from being in these spaces. And as we know, tourism's need to protect the goose, the gold, lays the golden egg. They've got more to gain from the protection of these spaces in that regard. So tourists to me are a very different group of people that are in place in these oceanic spaces and inland waterways, because they're not there to specifically, and I mean that sort of implicitly, yeah, exploit. We can see that in a more abstract sense, that tourism overall may be exploitative, but the tourists themselves are not there for that reason. They're not gaining anything from being in that space other than, as I said, an experience, and that experience relies on the health, if you like, of these environments. So for that reason, tourism for me is important in that it literally puts eyes in these places. And as you referred to earlier, a lot of these places are invisible to us. And a lot of the activity now taking place under this remit of the blue economy are taking place underneath the sea.
Yes.
So they are invisible. Yeah. We are reliant on reports back that may be dubious in some cases.
Yeah.
We're looking at impacts that we can't even imagine yet. I saw the other day just huge sonar blasts that are being done undersea, and the effects we're only just starting to understand on whales and dolphins, for example. So there's a lot happening there, and if you like, a lot of opportunity for exploitation that just isn't visible in the way that a lot of activities that take place on land might be. Mm-hmm. So we know when there's a mining company doing something that seems off, we'll see protesters there because they can see it happening. But in undersea environments, they're a lot more vulnerable because of their invisibility. So I think having tourists there can be a bit vexatious to some of these industries who might want to engage in practices that are less palatable, particularly because they're going to sort of ask questions.
Yes.
And they're important to, in that sense, to have these people there, almost like watchdogs, if you like, that can act ultimately and in the best cases as kind of check and balance on some of the other industry activity that's taking place, and that is tended to be privileged when we think about tourism, yeah, or the blue economy more generally. So I see tourists as possibly, at the very best, acting as a kind of stopgap, or at least as a kind of set of eyes that might get some other industry practices to think differently if we know that there is the presence of tourists,
yeah,
who can see what's going on.
Brilliant, yeah. And they, you know, the idea of being extractive, you know, tourists are not necessarily extractive in the way that the mining and minerals resources industries or fishing is, and on the blue spaces. But it also makes me think about how, you know, the archetype of the global commons are these blue spaces, and what one country does can have a ripple effect on many others. All right, so it's not like, you know, we have our own blue space and what we do, and that only impacts us. It has a, yes, ripple effect, impact on others, and makes me think of cruise tourism, which is, yes, which is not the topic of this discussion, but it has the way we look at the way we conceive of the blue economy and blue spaces is a particularly important question for cruise tourism. So with that said, Felicity, from a researcher point of view, there'll be many researchers listening in who are engaging with blue spaces and asking themselves, you know, how can I use this engagement to apply my research practice? What do you see as some of the challenges for scholars working with the blue economy concept?
Firstly, I think, and related, this relates to all scholars working with this concept, it's not clear. So, as I said earlier, this may be frustrating for some scholars, but perhaps a wonderful challenge for other scholars who see that ambiguity as an opportunity to make a statement. So there's something that you can say. There's not a hard and fixed definition. There's attempts to define it and looking at the evolution of the term and so on.
Yeah.
But it's very imprecise still. So that's one thing that can provide a challenge, I guess, for people working in this space. Secondly, and again, this isn't new to tourism scholars, but is double fold, I think, in this space. Tourism as an industry, and this frustrates me particularly, is underrepresented in a lot of the policy, but even in the scholarly discussions around the blue economy. And this is often the case. Often, you know, tourism scholars will say, well, tourism's kind of never really seen as central. It's always seen as this and also form of economic activity, and you have to sort of fight for it to be heard or taken seriously. in the academy, but also even in policy arenas, tourism's kind of seen as a nice add-on to other economic activities. And that's certainly the case when it comes to the blue economy. When I was working on this paper, I was really disheartened to see how tourism and leisure and recreation are sort of mentioned in the front end of reports as part of the blue economy. But then when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, they're completely forgotten. And the emphasis shifts towards those extractive industries, what we might call traditional industries, and the newer innovations, so offshore farming, the seabed mining. That's where all the interest and excitement and activity seems to be. And tourism just gets kind of left off the map as if it's, oh, it's just the sea resort, you know, the coastal resorts, that's about all it is. So that old friend of tourism scholars is still there when we visit the blue economy. It's still fighting to get tourism recognised for the place that it has. And I think it's particularly unjustified in the blue economy, because tourism has an enduring relationship with these spaces. It's not a new player in this field. I don't think it deserves to be marginalised. I think it deserves to have a really serious place in discussions about the blue economy, especially when we're talking about sustainability. So one of the keys there, and it's often referred to in discussions around sustainability in the blue economy, is, you know, stewardship of the environment. And I think tourists are best placed to achieve that. So I think they're very important as stewards. So it's frustrating to me that they kind of take second fiddle even in this space. So I think scholars need to reassert the importance of tourism in this space and to point to the long enduring relationship that tourism has with these places. Thirdly, I guess, and not only related to tourism, but more generally, there is the ongoing battle to remove the privilege afforded to economics.
Yeah.
So we talk about sustainability and then we talk about economics. So, and that exists here as well. So more attention to appreciating the ecological and social benefits and costs of working in these spaces, I think, is still there and needs to be worked at, because, as I said, some stakeholders and even policy documents do really see the blue economy as a kind of green light for supercharging economic activity in these new spaces. So I think the battle against that privileging of economics still exists when we think about the blue economy. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think the other challenge, it's a minor challenge, but I think it's still important, and particularly as we move forward with some of the kind of more dire outcomes that some people predict for the planet, is this persistent neglect of inland water spaces or freshwater spaces. So this privileging of blue being oceanic.
Yeah.
I think tourism can do a lot to redress that, because so much tourism, again, takes place in lakes and rivers. And that these are really important leisure spaces, and you know, destinations will centre themselves on these water spaces. If there is a water space, the destination will use it. So I think tourism can do a lot to redress that challenge of the privileging only of oceanic spaces. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, tourism a long friend of those spaces, or enemy, depending on how you see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're the challenges that researchers will encounter when looking to engage with the blue economy. Where the opportunities lie?
Well, many of those opportunities, I think, come out of an attitudinal flip of the challenges. So if you just see that challenge as an opportunity, then that is what it is. Mm-hmm. So I think tourism scholars can, and I think they should, step forward and play a much more significant role in clarifying what the blue economy is and making ourselves heard. By asserting, as I said, the significant presence of tourism, but also the long-standing presence of tourism. It's not a new industry in this space. It can't be just marginalised or put off to the side, I don't think.
Right.
And then related to this, so tourism's often seen as this marginal activity, a kind of residual activity that takes place outside of the important business of work or normal economic activity, whatever that might be, and that it takes place in marginal spaces. But in these places, it really does have a long-lasting presence. And not only that, but an innovative presence. So it innovates our relationships with oceanic spaces and the kind of encounters that we have with them. Even if we think about the kind of domestications of oceanic space like aquaria, that's taken on a whole new dimension with the invention of new kinds of acrylics that can hold, you know, literally entire ecosystems on land. Mm-hmm. So tourism and leisure have played a massive role and continue to play a massive role, not only in terms of its presence, but in terms of its innovative capacity in recreating encounters with these places. And that old argument of if you don't know it, you won't care about it. Well, tourism plays a big role in getting, in enabling us to know this place, which takes up such a huge part of our planet, and yet we know so little about it. So I think tourism in this space is a leader and not an afterthought. And I think that's an opportunity that we can build upon, particularly in making our voices heard. It also does what the economy sort of hopes to do, which is to connect up activities that might have been treated as disparate or discrete activities in the past. So the economy in general is looking to sort of take that broad lens towards all of the economic activity undertaken in these spaces. Mm-hmm. And that offers us an opportunity to rethink the way that we've thought perhaps about discrete orders of marine tourism, for example. We often tend to focus on particular activities, like coastal resorts or cruises or diving. They almost take on subsets of this broader notion of marine tourism. And I think the blue economy gives us permission and encourages us to think through the connectedness of those activities. But not only the interconnections between different tourism activities that take place in blue spaces or near to blue spaces, but also, say, for example, connections between tourism, hospitality, underwater hotels, and then undersea research stations, which basically provide the blueprint for the underwater hotel. So that sort of spans tourism into these other related areas, all within the concept of the blue planet, of the blue, blue economy. Likewise, things like coastal resorts, the development of undersea attractions off the shores of those coastal resorts, and then wind farming, which can provide this sort of clash. I think in Newcastle at the moment, on the east coast of Australia, there's a bit of a stoush happening because Newcastle sees itself as a kind of oceanic destination, and yet there's a push to put these big wind turbines out in the ocean. Yeah. And then there's that tendency, that clashing there between those two industries. And that's a traditional thing, and we've seen that before, but I think the blue economy really encourages us to look more closely at those intersectoral connections, but also connections within marine tourism itself and the kind of activities that take place there.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you raise the question of wind farms, because not only in Australia, but elsewhere, we see this the necessity to move towards renewable energy as a result of global warming. And here in Australia recently, as you would know, Felicity, people who are against the proliferation of turbines out in the ocean are saying that this is having an impact on whales, using it as a justification for not going there. But this emphasizes the way blue spaces are highly contested spaces because of this kind of jostling for the use of whatever resources the blue space offers. And if I can just draw on your paper, when you talk about the gaps in the literature and future research directions, you say, and I quote, you say that while the blue economy seeks to create a comprehensive framework for oceanic related economic activity, and in its fullest sense, to find a way to measure the sustainability of these, there remains a sectoral approach to the research. Across this is an emphasis on traditional economic activities like fishing and trade or shipping, and then on newer economic activities that make use of technological advancements of the types mentioned earlier in the paper. Sustainable marine tourism research is an example of the sectoral approach to research, but bewilderingly, in policy documents concerned with the blue economy, there's a sense that tourism is an afterthought. And for us who work in tourism and do research in tourism, that's an old lament, right? Tourism is an afterthought. And I wonder, Felicity, how do you see the future of tourism and the blue economy unfolding?
Well, I think the role of tourists within blue spaces, that sort of stewardship, surveillance role, will become more important because it's the only sector that sort of puts people without that direct relationship or economic relationship that puts them into those places. So I think that will become more important. And we can think here in terms of citizen science at one end, where we're drawing much more on tourists as citizen science to kind of take note of this. Tourists to the Barrier Reef in Queensland are one example. You know, they will be the first to tell you if they see degradation taking place over time. So I think they'll be very important stopgaps or checks and balances, particularly in those oceanic spaces and increasingly undersea as we're sort of seeding more tourists undersea. So I think they're going to be important in that stewardship angle, and I think tourism will take a much bigger space in that, which will be good. It will be good for the industry to see itself in that regard and perhaps behave more sustainably in response to us. So we'll see more of the presence of pesky tourists, as I think about them, who are going to stick their noses in perhaps where they're not wanted and create a bit of trouble for the industries that want to sort of see this as an invisible space where they might feel that they have an open check to do as they want.
Yes.
Referring back to my earlier point about leadership and my belief that tourism really is a leader and a leading economic activity in this space, I think tourism should and can step up and not underestimate itself and not play that sort of second fiddle anymore in this place, not only because it's justifiable when pointing to the vast presence of tourism in and around these spaces and the kind of, you can use those economic indicators, if you like, to state the importance of tourism. But also, as I said earlier, because tourism is one of the great innovators in this space. Mm-hmm. It's constantly pushing forward new technologies into new uses to get more people to appreciate these spaces or into these spaces. So I think we don't need to be apologetic in this space. I think we can stand forward as leaders. So, for example, undersea is more accessible than it's ever been. And on the back of this, we're seeing the seeding of more undersea attractions, which was sort of unheard of 20 years ago. An undersea attraction would be a sunken shipwreck. But now we're seeing undersea museums, undersea art galleries, submarine pods, different forms of scuba accessibility. So you don't even need a PADI certificate half the time now. Developing, and also little events like undersea weddings are becoming a big deal, and undersea memorial parks. People are literally having their memorials developed in undersea spaces. So I think this is a place where tourism is and has traditionally made bold moves, and I think it's a place where tourism scholars can do likewise. So I think there's a very exciting future for tourism scholars if they want to jump into this space, excusing the pun, and develop more of a presence in the blue economy.
Or shall we say, take a deep dive?
That, exactly. The metaphors are endless.
As we get towards the end of this podcast, I also wanted to paraphrase you again, which I think is an important aspect of the paper. You say in the paper, with greater attention and activity taking place in blue spaces, as resources continue to deplete and as knowledge of the environments that make up the greater volume of our blue planet develops at pace, the multifaceted role of tourism within, upon and against these spaces becomes ever more important. Drawing on the blue economy as a conceptual resource has the potential to assist researchers and industry to better connect with adjacent blue industry outcomes, to understand, prepare for, and respond to the transformations that are taking place within blue spaces, and finally, to take up more space in discussions that underappreciate the enduring presence of tourism within these water worlds. So with that said, Felicity, do you have any final remarks for those listening, whether they be researchers, policymakers, or industry practitioners? What would you say to them as a final takeaway?
Well, I was about to say, I don't think I could say it better myself than what you just said. It's nice to have my work read back to me. Just that it's a really exciting place. It's for those of you who are blue sky thinkers and those of you who want to get down to the nitty gritties of more practical empirical research, don't ignore these spaces, because I think they are the innovative end of tourism. They will continue to be the innovative end of tourism. And that's for all that tourism is about. All of the dimensions of tourism are at play in this space. I don't think it's going to go away. I think it's going to become a much more significant space for all sectors, mm-hmm. not only tourism. But I think this is one place where we really can put our foot forward, be proud, and say unequivocally that we are an important voice in this space, mm-hmm. which will be a nice change from the way things have been on land up until now.
Yes. Well, With that said, thank you, Felicity, for joining us today on the Tourism Geographies podcast. For those of you who are interested in reading the paper, and I encourage you to do so, the paper is titled Tourism in the Blue Economy. It was published on the 12th of December, about a month ago, and already it has received quite a large readership. Thank you, Felicity. And the paper, more importantly, is open access, so you are able to get access to the copy freely without any cost. So with that said, thank you very much, Felicity, for joining us today on the Tourism Geographies podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Joseph. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Felicity. And to those of you listening to the podcast, thank you for joining us on this episode of the Tourism Geographies podcast. We look forward to bringing you more from the journal Tourism Geographies on much of the research taking place around the world on tourism and its many associated parts. So as we say goodbye to Felicity in Sydney and me in Sydney, see you all next time on the Tourism Geographies podcast.